Welcome to Pep Talks, where we discuss productive educational practices. I'm Dr. Amy Graham, and I hope to challenge your ideas and attitudes about teaching by hearing different perspectives from valued members of our teaching community at the University of Arizona. Hello and welcome. Today we are here talking with Dr. Amy Drescher, who is in the School of Nutritional Science and Wellness. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, what is your current role here at the University of Arizona?
I'm an assistant professor of practice, and that basically means that 90% of my job is teaching, and 10% of my job is considered service. And that service could either be on campus or in the community.
Nice. As a part of your teaching, what classes do you teach?
Well, I'm kind of lucky because I get to do a little bit online and a little bit in person. And I also get a little bit of undergraduates and graduates. So I really get a good mix. I teach some of the introductory 101 nutrition classes that are predominantly freshmen and underclassmen. And I teach that in the in-person modality. And then I teach kind of a medical nutrition therapy type class for non-dietetics. Dietetics meaning training dietitians. We also have a nutrition science major that many health professionals take. So if they're going to go into dental school or be a nurse or a physical therapist, there's a nutrition and disease course for them. And I teach that in the fall. And then I teach a body composition class that really gets into the science of how you measure body composition. And we take that into different scenarios. So it could be healthy. It could be someone with an eating disorder. It could be an elderly person. It could be an athlete. So we kind of take it in these different populations and we learn how the science works and how it doesn't work in different situations. And that is an upper division 400 level class, and it's also a grad class. So we use a lot of literature in there and current literature, and we use the grad students as examples to the upperclassmen to show them, kind of scaffold a lot of the projects, like here's how the grad students do it. Now, Now you try. And It's definitely been interesting over the years to try to figure out how to do that without making the grad students mad. Like, why do we have to do that? But making it more fun to where it's kind of a collaborative, you work alone together, you know, because you have, you're in an online environment, so you're not at the same time, but there's different ways you can still connect the students working on something together, even on their own time.
Yeah.
So that class, and then what else do I do? And then in the spring, it's a little different. I still teach the intro class, but I teach nutrition counseling in the spring. So I step out of my science hat and put on my counseling hat. And we talk about a lot of motivational interviewing, which is a technique that originated with substance addiction and has branched out into other healthcare. And it basically has the person, your client, being the driver of the counseling session. So you don't make their goals, you don't tell them what they have to do and why. You try to get them to decide what they want to do and you coach them through. Oh. And it's really not very congruent to the other things we've learned. And so the dietitian, the future dietitians take this and they learn that, yes, all these things that you've learned, but the client still gets to decide what do they want to work on? Why is it relevant to them? And we practice on each other and we get a volunteer client and do counseling with them. And this year, I'm super excited. We're going to be utilizing these trained, they're almost actors, if you will, patients. They're not real patients, but they read this report and they're going to act as this person. And two students get to kind of try counseling with this person. And it's great because we're not grading them on counseling mistakes. they're getting to try it and make mistakes and learn from their mistakes. They get graded on a reflection, and the person who's acting as a client gives them feedback, not in their techniques, but as a person, how did it feel when you counseled me? Like, what's something that you liked? Well, I liked the way you greeted me, for example, but then I didn't like it when you started giving me bullet points of what to do, you know? Right. And then the person, so you get instant feedback instead of that delayed 2 weeks later type of feedback that we have to give sometimes because of the load that we have. And then they write a reflection about what they learned. And it's making me so happy because I didn't really like the idea of them not getting to practice much and then having this volunteer client. We want them to, the client, to get kind of a service, not, you know. That's really exciting to me. And I was the first one to take that course into the online environment to try to figure out how would you teach counseling to in online. It was tricky. So I had to utilize a lot of videos and different things like that so the student could see examples that I normally would be giving in class. And sometimes I record some lectures, but I've been really proud of how that is evolving. And the students do give me feedback that they found it valuable before going into their internship when they're going to be meeting with patients to know what kind of techniques to use, because that's not anything we talk about in our program, really.
I think that that being able to counsel somebody, interview somebody, have conversations about some of these maybe more sensitive topics,
right?
It's not really something that we've all been trained on in life.
Right.
I mean,
if you don't have a struggle, say it's about weight, if you don't struggle with your weight or haven't had people around you who have, it might be hard for you to be sensitive on how to ask a question without, you know, making someone feel shame, because there's a lot of shame already when people are overweight because they feel like they should know better. A lot of shoulds. I should know better. I shouldn't do this. I should. But you know, it's not always people's fault. It's a medical condition, and it's not as simple. And that's the other thing I should try to infuse into the classes. You know, weight is not just so simple, and behavior change isn't so simple. And what I start out early in the class, let's talk about a problem that you have that you know that you need to make a change, but you've been unable to do it. I said it could be anything from your sleep habits to, it doesn't have to be nutrition. It could be anything that you're struggling with right now. Do you procrastinate or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And we start kind of digging and they feel what that's like, you know, like the other thing is just self-exploration, knowing you can't be a good counselor if you don't know yourself well. So we do a little bit exploring early on in their personality traits and biases and things of that nature, and try to explore that a little bit before we get going.
I think it's really important to acknowledge and recognize within that realm that it isn't just that simple to lose weight. And, you know, there's a lot of factors that contribute to a lot of physical conditions, including weight gain or loss, that have to do with, you know, childhood trauma and have to do with,
and relationships with food that are sometimes built very negatively, because parents could be well-meaning, but kind of destroy the kid's ability to listen to their hunger cues. If you're always having to clean your plate, for example, maybe you're full, but you're taught consistently to eat over that fullness and not listen to your own cues, or they get hungry and it's not mealtime. And I get that you don't want your kids eating all day, but when their metabolism is quick and they need the food, it's like, give them, if they're saying their stomach is rumbling, feed. Because the thing that we do with adults that have a lot of problems with eating is try to get them to tune into their hunger cues and tune into the things that were naturally there that have been ruined over time, you know?
Yeah. Because I mean, a lot of people lack self-awareness in a whole host of realms, But with food, it is probably more common than not that people lack a self-awareness around their hunger cues, their even thirst, mm-hmm. You know, all that stuff. And so, or even sleep. I think that we don't really practice good self-awareness around right. a lot of stuff that makes it challenging both for, you know, whoever they're counseling, but for themselves as right. developing counselors.
And even back to my introductory classes, that's a lot of times their first time away from home, they're making their eating decisions. And a lot of them are under eating and they don't want it because they're told you're going to gain the freshman 15, like that's a disease or something. And so what I find when we look at their diets is they're eating less than 1,000 calories a lot of times. And so one of the things I tell them, if you're not feeding your brain, you can't really learn.
So I'm curious, how did you end up here? Did you always think to yourself, I want to be a teacher. I want to be teaching faculty. I want to be a nutritionist.
Well, when I came to college, I really didn't have in mind anything to do with science or PhD. I thought, oh, I'll be a writer or a lawyer or something. That's about how developed my career plans were. And when I came to college, it was a lot more challenging because I had always gotten A's in high school for the most part, but my high school wasn't very challenging. I grew up in New Mexico. And back then, I don't know how their schools are now, but back then they weren't horrible, but they didn't push you that much, you know? And so I came to college and had that feeling of maybe I'm not as smart as I thought, you know what I mean? Because yeah. like, this is really hard. And my parents did not go to college. My brother did, but you know, I couldn't really rely on my parents for college related advice nor any of my other relatives. So there was that. And I was just really afraid when I got there that kind of like imposter syndrome was starting, you know, yeah. I'm not as smart as I thought I was. I don't know if I really want to do this writing thing, you know, just like all
like
these,
I belong here.
Yeah. And when I would look around and everyone would be sunbathing out on the mall, I would think to myself, because I was kind of sheltered, that, oh, wow, how did they get all their stuff done? And it was never dawned on me that maybe they weren't doing stuff. You know, I was just like, dang, I don't have time for that. I got to go study. You know, yeah. I wish I had time to sunbathe. But anyway, so I took a nutrition 101 class and I was like, this is a thing? This people do. I had never heard of a dietitian in my life. I had a little bit of struggle with weight right before I went into college because I was a majorette and I was told at this one school that I didn't meet the height weight requirements and that I had to lose 10 pounds.
Interesting.
And I had crash dieted and ate only fruit for a couple of weeks because that's the library book that I found about losing weight.
Oh, wow.
I know. Pretty pathetic. I don't know why we weren't really taught much about nutrition in high school or anything. And I didn't know. So anyway, I felt horrible. I made the team. It was a school in Arkansas, but there was weekly weigh-ins and it just didn't seem like a good path for me.
Yeah.
So the last minute I applied to the University of Arizona and got in there. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because my revelation was, wow, people wouldn't have to go through what I did because you could learn the right ways to watch your weight. Or I wasn't even focused on it was inappropriate for me to lose weight in the first place. I wasn't even on that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, because you're 18 or whatever, you know. But yeah. I was like, I would learn the proper ways to do stuff and I could help other people so they wouldn't struggle the way I did. And I felt terrible. And this is a thing. And I got really jazzed. And I think mid-semester of my nutrition 101, I already changed my major. And the only problem with that is I had taken the bare minimum of science to graduate high school because I'm like, I don't need that. I'm going to be a writer or a lawyer. I don't need. So I had taken bare minimum and including skipping physics altogether. And at that time, nutrition sciences did require physics. Science really almost did me in. And I really wanted to do this. And I just really had to figure it out. And back then, we didn't have as many resources as students have today for getting help. So a friend of mine, her boyfriend was in engineering school. He was good at physics. I'm like, great. I'll pay you $5 a session because I didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Fine with that. And so I kind of found my own help because physics was just something, the way they had it organized, there wasn't a lot of help because I was completely lost and I didn't even know what questions to ask. Sure. And so I felt intimidated to ask faculty because I thought, oh my God, they're going to think I don't belong here and I'm a fool. And so I didn't understand the whole purpose of, you know, that. So I didn't utilize that. But by the time I got later into it and I was in organic chemistry, I realized that the professors were people I could actually talk to and ask help. And I did. And lo and behold, I somehow got an A in organic chemistry because I got the help that I needed and I wasn't afraid to ask for it.
Yay.
So things changed for me once I started advocating for myself and realizing that I belong here just as much as everyone else. So it took a couple of years for me to realize, you know, that some people it's easier for them, but some people just have to work harder. And I came from sort of an athletic background where you work at stuff and you practice and you practice and you practice. So I just drew on my life experience was you're not supposed to be good at the beginning, but if you practice, you can get better, you know, and somehow got me through. And I went into the program to be a registered dietitian, and that requires getting an internship. And I did that in Kansas, and I started my graduate degree in Kansas simultaneously while I was doing my internship, and it was very rigorous, intense, and it was great. And I was going to finish my master's there, but I found out that I didn't have any choice in my research and that I would be required to do a rat study with iron metabolism. And I kind of have a rodent aversion. I don't know what it is. I can handle reptiles. I can handle bugs, but there's something about even like, I don't even like ferrets and stuff. I just,
yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
None of that. And just the thought, and I had no interest in iron metabolism. It just didn't. And the thought of spending 2 years living in, and basically I was not wanting my parents to pay for that degree. And so I didn't have a lot of money, and Kansas City is a type of place where it's fun if you have money. There's sports teams, music, all these things. But if you're on a grad student budget, I felt like this place is no fun. I don't like rodents. I don't care about iron. And so I left, but I did get my internship. I completed and graduated with my internship so I could work as a dietitian. But I decided I'm just going to go back to the U of A and talk to them and see, you know, if I can finish there. And it was kind of a rude awakening to find out that I had 22 graduate credits under my belt by then. And when I got to the U of A, if I did their master's, they would only accept 6.
Oof.
And financially, I was like, I can't throw my money away like that. Yeah. And I didn't know quite what to do. And one of my advisors was like, you know, if you went into the PhD program, we would take all of your credits. And see, I'm young. I don't know what I'm agreeing to. The next thing I know, I'm like, yeah. And they're like, we think you could do it, you know, and that's all you had to say. And they believe that or not, I don't know, but they said it and I took it in and I'm like, they think I can do it. So I can do this, you know? And I was a very self-motivated, driven type person. But, you know, in retrospect, it was a lot to take on. I took a job as a clinical dietitian for like 28 hours a week. I did not take a TA ship. And I do think that because of that, I didn't get much mentoring because I just wasn't around. I was working this job, but I needed that job because it paid for my rent, paid for my health insurance, all those things. And at that time, the graduate TA was going to be about half of the amount that I was bringing in. So
yeah,
I just felt like they sort of weren't happy with me because I wasn't doing that. I was treated differently. Even when it came to my defense, they forgot to announce it. I mean, just stuff like that. You forgot. I mean, yeah. You know, so there, I did not get the best mentoring. The person that I chose to be my main advisor was kind of the type of person is like, when she was on, she was really on, but when she wasn't, she was horrible. Yeah. So, and I never knew what I was going to get, but thankfully the other people on my committee were pretty stable. And I was able to finish despite, you know, the problems. But my story is a little weird because I didn't finish right away. I finished all my data collection for my dissertation, finished my comps and everything. And all I had to do was finish the dissertation and defend it.
Just and two tiny details.
That's all, those tiny things. Instead, what I did is get married and move and start a new job.
Oh, wow.
And I still thought that I could do the PhD. I'll just do it on the weekends. I mean, that's how unrealistic I just was. I didn't know better.
I think that this is the story or your journey. It really demonstrates where first generation students or even, you know,
right,
lots of students, even if they're not first generation students, just lack an awareness.
Right.
And it's not your fault that you didn't know. You know, we could throw blame around all day long, but.
Oh, and you know, I did that for years. And I finally decided that, you know what, if you do finish your PhD or if you don't, no one cares why. Sure. You care, but nobody else does. You either do or you don't. And so I started that job and it was a research job. So it was really intense. And I was trying to finish my stuff on the weekend. And there was this famous researcher was working with us. I was at the University of Colorado in a research center there and working as a research dietitian. And one of my colleagues, through the grapevine, I heard he had said about me that, oh, she'll never finish. And I really would like to thank the man because that made me so angry that I was done in 6 months after that.
Wow.
And I finally realized that your excuses, they're legitimate, but they don't matter in terms of no one's going to go, oh, she didn't do it because of that. Oh, she didn't do it because of this. You either do or you don't.
Sure.
Ultimately. And yes, I had excuses and everything else, but there's still, you know, I'm sure a lot of my habits played a part in where I was in my journey and my inability to understand how long things take and taking things on. So, you know, my immaturity probably was some of where I was at, but ultimately I decided that all the sacrifices that I made and things that I didn't do so that I could work on my research was for naught. If I didn't finish, then I was dishonoring all of that. And there was this light bulb was like, you know what? I did those things for a reason. And I want to finish for me. And I no longer knew exactly professionally what I was going to do with it. But I knew I never was satisfied just being a dietitian. I'm not belittling the career is great and everything, but I was always asking questions. Well, why do we have to do it like this? And I read this and da, 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 da. And I have a really inquisitive mind. So mm-hmm. I know this about myself and I wanted the PhD to have the tools to use my questions for my career. So I wanted it for me. And I, you know, after that, I ended up moving here to Arizona and leaving that research job. And I had a lot of years where I just didn't find a good fit for me. And I tried all kinds of things. I dabbled. And even though it's kind of bad, you have this PhD and you're just here, there and doing these different jobs. I was working part time so I could raise my kids. I didn't want someone else raising them.
Yeah.
And so that was a good thing. But what I bring to the classroom now is I've done a little bit of a lot of things. And so I'm not a researcher in one topic like iron metabolism. I can't tell you the ins and outs of one thing, but I can tell you a little about a lot of things. And my research job in Colorado was like that. It was different every day. And all these different populations. And so I bring those experiences to my class and I try to give them examples that bring things to life rather than just everything's based on a book or something like that. I like to just infuse them with some life examples.
First of all, congratulations for finishing your degree. in the face of, I'm sure, a lot of difficulty. It's not easy to finish a degree when you don't even have a job or anything else going on. That's hard enough, but to do it right while you're working and while you're living a life, it's a challenging thing. Good for you for taking what somebody said in a negative way and turning it into a final product, which is a dissertation. Yeah. Now, and I also want to congratulate you for finishing a dissertation, finishing a PhD with a dearth of mentorship. Many of our advisors in these roles in PhDs, many of them are not trained to be good mentors and they lack the ability to mentor in productive ways. Mm-hmm. And it's a really tough thing to be a graduate student in one of those situations where your mentorship is not appropriate for your needs. And so I think that it's important to celebrate the fact that you were able to find your way out of that, because I can appreciate how hard that is.
Yeah, there was a lot of tears, a lot of frustration, but also just a lot of growth, you know, The determination that I had overcame, like you said, there was negativity.
You know, it demonstrates, a certain amount of fortitude and resilience to be able to power through that. And I know that I had challenges when I was a graduate student. I took 10 and a half years to finish my degree, you know, and then you're filing for extensions. So your coursework will have to retake the courses. And so it's tough. And
I did mine right at year 10. So I totally know. And I kept paying just to be enrolled and I wasn't getting, I'm like, at least if I'm paying money, I want to get something.
Yeah. But then there's also, there's all the people around you. Like, one of the questions that I hated the most when I was a graduate student was, when are you going to be done? You know, and it's just something little like that just,
yes,
you're like, I'm in a room and I feel like I'm a caged raccoon or something.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to find the first door out. Can I just get out of the room? Because people are asking me when I'm going to be finished. I think that people feel a lot of shame. I know that I felt a lot of shame.
I did too.
For not finishing or for taking so long. And I suffered. I mean, I definitely had anxiety, maybe some depression involved. And my mom, I remember my mom saying to me, Amy, something's wrong with you. Which is lovely to hear. Thanks,
yes,
mom.
Yes.
But something's wrong with you. You need to go get help. You need to go to a counselor. You need to see a therapist. And I remember just thinking, something is wrong with me. I don't know what's wrong with me, but something's wrong with me and something must be flawed with me that I can't finish this.
Right, right.
I had those moments and my mom, at my mom's request, I went to CAPS, Counseling and Psychological Services here at the U of A, and I talked with a therapist, and actually they gave me some really profound coping skills to get through some of those really dark times when I was like, I was just truly arrested. I was paralyzed.
Right. And I definitely experienced periods of time where I was like that, and I would feel guilty for having any other like pleasure.
Yeah.
That during that time, like, oh, I'm not allowed to do these things. And still to this day, I feel like some of my friendships, I sort of blew it during that period of time with people because I just wasn't available. I didn't have anything left, you know? And so I just think back at that. And I do regret, you know, getting out of touch with people, but there was just limits, you know? It's like, now I can use the term bandwidth. There just wasn't any left, you know?
Yeah. You're saying you're not making yourself available. You're also punishing yourself.
Yes. Yeah. You know?
Like, I did that too. I would just punish myself. I am, you know, not worthy. I'm lazy. The fact that I can't get this done. Yeah. I just punished myself so much.
Right. Yeah. I went through phases. Like for a while, it wasn't my fault, you know? And then, you know, then it's back to, it's my fault. It's like all these things that you go through. It's like, no, other people have used her as an advisor and they got their degree. So it must be me then, you know, like just all this like questioning. And then if you talk to the people around you who are not in academia, they'll give you advice that, oh, you should report them and you should do this and you should do that. And you're like, I didn't need that. I want my degree and out. I would like my degree delivered to me. I don't want to jeopardize that package.
And part of it too, is that there's this weird power dynamic.
Oh, totally.
You know, when you're a graduate student and this one person really holds the keys to your ability to not just get through and get the degree, but they kind of, I mean, in a lot of ways, they hold the keys to your entire future.
Right.
Because anybody that ever hires you, they're going to want to hear from your PI, from your principal investigator on your dissertation.
Right.
And you feel you're bound to them in such, in such a terrifying way.
Right. And I would just tell those people, I can't burn bridges. That's just, I know what you're saying is logical, but later in life, when I've had different conflicts, I didn't have experience advocating for myself because I didn't really have to because I had positive work environments. So then when my work situation wasn't as positive, I didn't really have those skills, you know, and now I can see it. Hindsight's 2020 and growth and all of those things. I can see that I should have advocated for myself differently and more. But at the time, I was just so blindsided, like, is this for real?
Well, and honestly, you were doing the best you could, you know?
Right.
Honestly, and you really didn't know how to maneuver through those things. And so you just did the best you could.
Right.
And so just again, I want to reiterate how amazing it is that you did make it through, and you should celebrate that. I don't know, pick a day every year.
It's kind of fun that you're saying that, because I didn't, even though I'm proud of myself, I don't really think about that. And I should celebrate it on a regular, because it was really a big feat, you know?
Yeah, it's huge. Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, you have overcome, and you probably did it on your own, but you overcame so much to just get through it, get it done, and put a stamp on it, go.
Right.
To me, it was November 12th of 2010. That was the day that I defended. And I honestly and sincerely thought I was going to fail. My advisor almost refused to sign my paperwork saying he was going to be at my defense. He made me argue with him. And like, I had told him, you know, I don't care if I fail, this needs to get done.
Right.
And I hit a moment where I just said, it just needs to be done. And I hadn't really gotten any feedback on any of the dissertation that I had written. So based upon his feedback, I thought that I was going to fail. So when I went in 2 weeks later to go and do my presentation and my defense, that was the mindset that I was in. When in fact, it went quite well and I got through it. I had some minor adjustments to be made and turned it in and was done. But so yeah, my defense was November 12th of 2010. And to me, that is a date to be celebrated for me, because in those 10 and a half years, that was a lot. It's a lot of, when are you going to be done?
Right. Yeah, I defended at 2 p.m. and my advisor finally decided to make changes at 11 on that day, to my presentation and my slides and everything. And it was just like,
at that point, it's not worth it. Yeah.
In her apology, she spoke about herself in the third person. She said something like, well, this is just, say her name was Betty. It wasn't. This is just Betty being Betty.
Yeah.
That was her way of saying sorry. So I pretty much haven't talked to her since. It was just, I was just done. Like, I respect you for what you gave to me, but I'm done because of all the things you didn't give to me, you know?
There are so many relationships in our lives that aren't what we would hope.
Right.
And aren't, we don't get what we want. We don't get what we need. There's a Rolling Stones or something song about that.
But you do learn. You do learn, even though you're not getting what you wanted, you do learn.
You figure it out.
You learn, maybe you don't want to mentor people like that and what you would have liked. And you try to give students what you didn't get. You do use it for learning. That's what I'm always telling students. If you get feedback that you hate or it makes you feel horrible or, you know, you don't respect the person giving it, so you're not going to listen. Instead, try to get a little nugget of something. There should be a nugget there. Even if it's false, it could be, well, why are you perceiving it that way? And is there something that you can learn? Is there a nugget of anything that you can use instead of just putting up that defensive front? Like, because I think sometimes when we're offended by something, we don't want to listen to any of it because that person, we don't value what they're saying. But just trying to have a little bit of a thicker skin and try to see if there is something there that you can take from that.
And I think maybe not even a thicker skin, but kind of almost shed your skin and be willing to examine what truth could be within those critiques.
Yes, the layers of not so good, but is there something there of value that you can take away from that experience? And that's something I tried to do.
I think a lot of people, when they look at those of us that are standing in front of a classroom, literally or figuratively, as a professor or as a PhD, they kind of think that we had some perfect path or some easy path to get to where we are.
Or we're kind of geniuses.
It's funny because, you know, in an ideal, most of my classes are first year undergraduate students. They're freshmen. And so they think that I must have had some, you know, divine path, you know, to get to where I am. And in reality, I struggled, I suffered, I really was challenged a lot. And it brought me to a space where I had to learn how to be kind and compassionate to myself and to forgive myself for all of those negative, punishing thoughts and attitudes that I had and I held quite tightly about myself. That I had to find some way to get through it, to accept myself in this role, because I think I was so negative toward myself that I didn't have the respect for myself.
Yeah.
To feel like I could be this role, be this person, be this professor. And I had to kind of find my way through my own self-worth and find that compassion for myself. And then I actually used that as a way to find compassion for my students who were struggling in learning, you know, the material. I mean, I teach chemistry, and so, you know, there's a huge stigma around that, but it was a tough journey for me emotionally, in addition to academically.
Right. I think sometimes students of today, the one thing I will say is I feel like sometimes they lack that grit for just working towards something and getting through the struggle. Because I think that the generations are different. I'm a lot older and I'm raising kids that are the age. I have two college age kids right now. One just graduated. Yay. But I do know that age group. And I do find that you let them know this is going to be hard. And it's okay. It should be hard. And that I didn't get it right away either.
Yeah.
And that through this struggle, if you're willing to stick with it, you will learn it. But that uncomfortableness with the struggle part is what I'm getting at. I'm not saying they're all wimps. I don't mean that. Yeah. I just mean that when things get tough, what do you do then? Do you panic? Mm-hmm. Do you check out? Because a lot of the kids just check out. It's too hard, you know?
I mean, some of it is that this world is very complicated right now, and that it's very easy to just check out. I mean, yes, heck, half totally the time I want to check out.
I do too. I
Where's
do too.
The door? I'm the raccoon. Like, who yes. wants to ask me when I'm going to be done? Because I'm running. But I think that also, I think that a lot of, you know, parents of this generation, I'm not saying it's you, but a lot of parents have had a habit of hovering over their children yeah. in a way where, you know, the students can check out and the parents will step in and yes, figure it out yes. for them. And so, and that's not very constructive in terms of building resilience and building the ability yes. to solve those problems.
I know I used to sometimes feel guilty that I wasn't more of a hovering parent because I would see my friends doing more of that. And I'd be like, not doing it because I wasn't raised that way. And my husband wasn't either. And so we're more a little bit on the tough love side of things. Like, oh, I don't like my teacher. You're not going to like all your teachers, yeah. you know? Or this isn't fair. Well,
life you know, isn't fair, my life friends.
Life isn't fair. And so that was our pretty much.
Oh,
the
there's
way
a song. Care. It's by yeah. the Rolling Stones. It's called "You Can't Always Get What You Want."
Oh,
you
totally. Know? That we should play that in the background. That's like classic.
I know. I actually, that's the song I play on the first day of class.
Do you?
Uh huh. Yeah, and I feel like it kind of sets a tone and. You know, I think this brings me to one of my questions for you is I try to set the tone for my students that learning is going to be hard and that it's going to be a struggle and it's going to be uncomfortable, but let's work on it together. And so one of the things that I try to do is to set that tone. And one of the things that I'm trying to do when I'm doing that is to reach those first generation college students, the students that maybe come from families that are unfamiliar with the educational process or with the, you know, university itself. What are things that you do to try to support those students who are much like you were coming into your undergraduate career?
I try to tell them that I was them too. That was me. And that I didn't utilize all the things that were available to me because I always kind of thought it was for somebody else. I don't know. Or I was intimidated to ask. I didn't even know where to start. But letting them know that that was me and that there's all, if they feel more comfortable, they could ask my TA or the preceptor, but that I'm approachable and that I'll have a conversation with you and see if I can get you started. Including if you do horrible on an exam, I'll sit down with you. We'll go through it, you know?
Do you ever talk about any of the struggles that you had as a student or that you had?
I think I do mention the not using the resources part because I did use them later and it really changed my experience. Granted, I wasn't a freshman anymore, but sure. I just didn't utilize things the way I should. I was afraid, embarrassed, whatever. I just didn't have the confidence to do it, you yeah. know? But I think I do mention it. I think I probably could mention it a little bit more, but I do mention it early on, but there's so much that gets mentioned early on in information overload. And yeah. that's something I'm working on with my teaching is that I tend to be on the information overload because when I was learning, there wasn't an internet, okay? I'm that old. And so I was sort of a giver of information as a dietitian even. They couldn't yeah. just Google, how do you eat for an ulcer or whatever. I was the giver of that information. Here you go from my magic file, you know?
Yeah.
And so students of today, I mean, they're savvier with technology and everything else. And they don't, you know, necessarily respond the way we did back then, you know? And so I can't necessarily teach the way I learned things and expect sure. today's generation to respond the way I did.
You yeah, know? No, I totally get that. Well, and it's interesting because, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of attitudes toward teaching, particularly that they're is just so much information out there. Like, what is the goal of us teaching at all? Because there's, you know, they can go out and access information readily. So what's the point of higher education?
Right.
So I'm curious, you know, thinking about it from that perspective, you know, to you, what is the point of you bringing students together in a classroom setting to help them learn about nutritional science? Like, what do you value that time for?
I think my biggest priority is supporting their learning on critical thinking. So it doesn't matter which class I'm teaching, I want to get them critically thinking about it. They're so worried about getting the answer. Just get the answer and get it down, get the answer. But I want them to think about it and explore the ideas more and know how to poke holes in something. So if someone says, there's this new diet supplement and it, you know, makes me have so much energy, and that look at all these people, they've been taking it and they have all this energy. And then for the science person in me wants them to go, well, how do they know that it was that? Could it have just been their belief it was going to help them, like the placebo effect? And how would someone know if that was a legitimate product? What things would you look for? How would you research that? Like, all, I just want to build that curiosity and that critical thinking and almost skepticism on things.
Yeah, I love that. That is almost more important than the actual disciplines that we're teaching them. Because I teach chemistry, and most of my students are not going to go on to be chemists.
Right.
And so to me, I would rather have them take some of the foundations, but also take this, how do we think through things? How do we decide if that is a good prediction? How do we decide if that is a decent explanation? And so I think that those are really critical skills. So you're supporting critical thinking. You want students to struggle and evaluate how relevant pieces of information are, like if people believe that a supplement makes them feel better. I'm wondering what that looks like in your classroom. Like, how do you use the time in your classroom to support that goal?
So I'm thinking about my counseling class. We do a little project in there where we try to take a controversial topic and we try to look at it from a layman's perspective. And it's so hard for them. By the time they're a senior and they've been looking at science, 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 I said, I want science. Go on TikTok, go Instagram, whatever you do. I don't know what the latest is always, you know, but Whatever it is. What are people hearing and seeing from each other? What are they talking about? And most times what I'll get back from them is a summary of layman things on the computer, like WebMD or Mayo Clinic or ClevelandClinic.org or whatever. And I'm like, no. And they don't get a passing grade for that, because that's not what I asked you.
Yeah.
That's an educated person getting consumer information, which is not the assignment. So we get sort of like, what do the layman, and that's really hard for them. And then we look at a little bit at the science, and that's still hard for them. And they're seniors, but a lot of times they don't know how to pick study design, like which would be stronger. So maybe they're giving me epidemiology when a stronger study design is available, but they're giving me epidemiology, which you can't show cause and effect. You can just show a relationship. But it could be correlated. People who wear purple pants are actually really good at telling jokes. That could be correlated, but not meaningful, right? So if I thought purple pants would make me funny, I would wear them. But, you know, funny looking is not what I'm going for. So yeah. I don't wear them. But so that's one example. And the other example is just giving them different little prompts and having the students write a response and then talk amongst themselves and kind of tally up, you know, how is your table weighing in on that? And did you learn, when you listen to their points, did you learn, you know, what did you learn from your partner type thing? Kind of like a share and compare activity, some of those types of things. Yeah. But I try to write some of the things. I really want to know their critical thoughts and not the answer. And they can't stand that sometimes. And it's harder to grade. It takes more time. Yeah. But I do some of that because I just feel like you cannot teach nutrition related topics without those types of questions once in a while.
I think that it's really important as teachers to try to stimulate a connection between what they maybe already have known in their everyday lives and what you're trying to teach. Because I think that when you can find ways that they can connect with the material,
right,
it becomes more meaningful, and it almost like creates a need to know. It creates a buy-in from the students, right, to say, you know what, I can relate to that. And I think I want to figure something. I want to figure that out.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, with chemistry, we could try to find, you know, and chemistry is everywhere, you know, it's in nutrition and it's definitely in medicine and it's in food and pesticides and nutrients and
odors even.
I was just going to say Bath and Body Works. Yes. Yes. But it's all over the place. I think that finding contexts that are relevant to the students is a great technique to get them to become more curious about those topics. Because I think instilling some kind of a curiosity when we're teaching is really important, you know?
Right.
What is their natural predisposition toward these different topics? I think it is definitely something that's a really important thing to do. I think it's interesting. You said you worked with students and having their tables weigh in. At the University of Arizona, we have these collaborative learning environments where we can teach in a space that I liken to a wedding reception.
We should do the placeholder.
The wedding reception size that I teach to is about 250 students. I'm curious, wow, what the wedding reception size is that you teach to in your class.
I'm a little blessed because I just have the 150. And I built up to that. I started with 100 and they kept giving me a little more. And then when I got to 150, I'm like, Uncle, can I stop here?
Enough, please. Enough.
Yeah.
So when you're teaching in those environments, those spaces are very different because, you know, there is no real like quote formula, unquote front of the room. And there, right. Yeah, you're right. There is no formula. There is no one right way. What is your approach to teaching in those spaces?
Well, I definitely try to get them to work in a group. And when I was talking to my TA kind of regrouping when we were done with the semester about a couple of students that would insist on sitting by themselves, despite me saying sit at a table with at least one other person.
Yeah.
But I didn't force, because of COVID, I didn't force that issue like I normally would have. Yeah. I normally would have been like, you know, you really need to be at a table with at least one other person. And she just repeatedly did it. And like I said, I just decided that I wasn't going to make it a deal because of COVID. But ordinarily, I don't have a problem with that. And they don't mind sitting together. And so the thing that I'm working on is getting roles for people. I used to just sort of like free for all it. We're in a group and whatever happens, happens. But I've been trying to make one person a spokesperson at the table. One person can kind of be the record keeper and keep the tally. And I feel like being a little bit prescriptive, still they can do it the way they want, but a little bit prescriptive sort of fights the tendency for a couple of people to sit there like a lump on a log and not do anything.
It's tough. I mean, I've been teaching in those spaces since fall of 2015.
Wow.
So it's been a minute since I've been teaching in them. And and one of the things that happened to me when I did them, which doesn't mean it'll happen to you and it doesn't mean it'll happen to anybody else, but I shifted them. And so I assign groups, I take attendance, and that's how I ensure the students are sitting in their groups as opposed to outliers. I also don't have enough space in the room so that the students could really sit by themselves.
Right. This room was huge. Yeah.
But I will say, when I assigned roles, the spokesperson, note taker, what I found was that if I shifted the roles routinely, so like the role shifted each class period, so the spokesperson was person number one, and then the next class period, it was person number two, and then person number three, and person number four. What I found is that when it would come to them, they wouldn't show up.
Wow. It was that disturbing to them.
They were that stressed about being a spokesperson that they just wouldn't come. And I thought that was interesting because it was pretty rare when I had, you know, whether I'm in one classroom where there were 44 tables or the other classroom where there were 60 tables, that it's pretty rare that a table would be called on and the spokesperson would have to speak. But what I found was that that was stressful enough that it was impacting their ability to show up.
Wow.
In spite of the fact that I was taking attendance. Mm-hmm. So I ended up scrapping the roles. What I found was most beneficial and conducive to getting students to actually talk to each other. It is a challenge. It's a very real challenge. Is assigning groups. So not letting them self-select who they sit with. It helps to neutralize a lot of like the social barriers. Mm. And so, because they're all in the same spot where they essentially don't know each other.
Right.
And that in doing that, it helps bring them together to have conversations about the content that we're intending to talk about. But then I think also setting the tone on those days, on the first day of a group assignment.
So on your first day, after you take attendance, do you just put it into some spreadsheet and figure out who's where?
So I assign them to the tables where they sit. You know, I pull their names out of D2L. I sort them. So students will now know how I assign groups. I sort them alphabetically.
These are secrets, aren't it? Okay.
Jen Kim's secrets. I sort them by last name. And then I put 1, 2, 3, 4. And so if I have 44 tables, then I do 1 through 44. And then when I get through the D's or whatever, C's or the D's, then I go 1 through 44 again. And then I'm at the, the H's, and then I go 1 through 44. And really what that does is it just prevents, you know, all the Gonzaleses from sitting at the same table and all the Smiths from sitting at the same table. It just kind of prevents that. Or if you have like twins in the class,
I had twins last time.
And so it just prevents them from sitting together. And there's other crafty ways. You can sort them by their UANet ID. You can sort them by their first names. You can sort them if they're different sections. You can sort them by section. There's a lot of different ways you can sort them by. I do a thing called a mail merge. So in Microsoft Outlook, you can do a mail merge where you use an Excel spreadsheet. And as so long as you have an email address in that spreadsheet, you can email everybody on the spreadsheet a column affiliated with that email, which would be the table number. And so I assign the groups. And so when they come to class, when they arrive in class, they know that they are looking for a specific table number. So the table numbers are out on the tables. There's a scheme usually for each classroom of table numbers. And then I post that in D2L so that they kind of know what part of the room they're supposed to look for. And so then I set them at, and so they know where to go. And on those first days, so I assign groups every 5 weeks. So they have three different group assignments over the course of a semester. And then what I do is on the first day is I really try to set the tone. I have them talk to each other and get to know each other. What's your major? What are your hobbies? What's your background? You know, do you live on campus or off campus? You know, those types of questions to get them familiar. But then I also have them talk to each other. How are we going to be successful as a group? To help them think about, you know, what are we going to do to ensure our collective success? Mm-hmm. The only points that are affiliated with their groups are attendance, you know, and I take attendance. And then I try as best I can to do group evaluations. where they go in, and I can talk about that offline, but they go into a program and they answer questions about themselves and about their group mates. And those questions are about three different components. And I call them the three P's now. Were they routinely present for the entire class period? So, you know, are they showing up late all the time? Right. Or, you know, and even if they are late, I'm usually pretty okay with that. Better late than never is my philosophy. Are they present? Are they routinely prepared for class? And are they routinely participating? So those are my three P's. Are they present, prepared, participating? And so really, I learn a lot from the participating aspect. If they're there and they aren't talking, it is incredibly clear in the peer evaluations. And it's a part of their grade. Their attendance and participation is worth 5% of their grade. So it might knock them down by a percentage point in the class. Mm-hmm. So if they were going to get a 95, they would get a 94. But I think that it's important for them to understand that that's a part of the game here. You know, this class requires that you are participating in these discussions. I don't require you to turn anything in as a group, but I want you to talk to each other because verbalizing information is a way of processing it. So, but I also let them know that's my philosophy and that learning how to talk and have discussions with people about material is, you know, it's a good soft skill. Learning how to work together is a good soft skill. It's definitely something that we need more of in this world, and being able to disagree and have constructive right. conversations, I think it's really important. And so, you know, I think that neutralizing the socialness, the social issues by assigning groups, and then setting the tone on the first day of each group assignment is really important. Facilitate students working together.
I haven't totally nailed it. I'm getting better every time. And that's the important part. Yeah. But I wouldn't say I've got it all nailed, but I'm now mentoring new employees. And I'm finding that kind of interesting because sometimes they teach me a few things. And that's great.
I think that the beauty of this is that we are in an educational environment. The prerequisite, I feel like, for being in an educational environment is that we are in a position of not knowing everything. And so honestly, I feel like we're all learning. I think the students are learning, they're learning our disciplines, they're learning how to negotiate their way around campus and in our classrooms. But I think that we're also learning as instructors too. You know, we're constantly learning new things. I'm constantly learning new things and learning how to do things better. And I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with me about your remarkable journey. And again, I think you should celebrate the fact that you finished your PhD. It's remarkable and it's amazing and it deserves recognition for sure. Cause I personally know how hard it is. So
thank you. Yeah, that's been kind of a fun part of our conversation, me realizing that it'd be fun to celebrate that.
Yeah. Because I think that we tend to get really down on ourselves about those kinds of things, and we're embarrassed or ashamed or whatever. But and I have had those moments and I still do. But I think that the fact that you pulled yourself through it and out of it, it deserves recognition. And it is much easier to just quit or not finish. Much easier.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear about how many people had similar struggles. And at the time when you're going through it, you honestly do feel like you're about the only one going through something like this.
For sure. I did. I think that's also part of why it's very important to share our experiences and find safe places to talk about these things. Because I do think that we all are better for finding that connection than we were to just pretend like it didn't happen. Well, I appreciate your time and I appreciate you being here with me.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Pep Talks, where we talk about productive educational practices. Please remember that there is always room for improvement. This is Amy Graham. Take care of yourself.